dynamics in a broader framework of theories described in terms of convex sets, or in terms of this operational structure we call test spaces. And there were two main formalisms I introduced. The first was this test space formalism, where you just have a set of possible outcomes of experiments, and it's organized into a bunch of subsets, each one of which represents a single experiment, and the elements of the set are all its possible outcomes. So it's a very weak framework, very loose. You can formulate all kinds of operational structures you might want to, or even mathematical structures that maybe don't have an operational interpretation. But it can serve a lot of purposes. And then we introduced the notion of a state on one of these test spaces. And the idea of a state was that it was just a function assigning a probability to each outcome in this set of possible outcomes in such a way that the outcomes that live together in a single test always add up to one for every test. So it's just, you know, just plain old common sense about how probabilities should behave in a situation where you're modeling a system on which you can do a variety of alternative experiments. Okay, then we talked about the set of all possible states on such a system, such a test space, and the fact that that formed a convex set, and under very weak conditions, it's a convex compact set, which means that it's sort of bounded in its extent, and it's closed. It contains all its limit points. And the closure is really just a matter of mathematical convenience. I mean, the limit points, you know, what you're saying when you say it contains all its limit points is that if I have a sequence that's converging to something, I might as well throw in that thing that it's converging to. And, you know, since this space is sort of parameterized by probabilities, you can't operationally tell the difference between this thing that's being converged to and all the things that are approaching it. So if it's mathematically convenient to throw in you know, to make the set closed, you might as well do it because you're not throwing anything in that's going to be operationally distinguishable at finite precision from what you've already got. And the motivation for making this thing closed, of course, is that then you have the Krein-Milman theorem available. You have a convex compact set of states, and if it's closed, you can express any point in the interior as a convex combination of so-called extremal states. And remember that the extremal states were the ones that had no non-trivial expression as a convex combination of other states. So if you look at anything that's done in this framework where they try to prove something, you're going to see that about half the time, half the proofs you run into, people will say, well, let's express an arbitrary state as a convex combination of extremal states and go from there. So it's a very convenient and harmless thing to do, to have a state space that's a convex compact set. Okay, then I also reviewed this so-called convex operational framework, which doesn't necessarily start with test spaces, but just starts with the very idea that the state space of a system is a convex compact set. And it asks, given such a set, what would be the mathematically possible, reasonable ways of assigning of describing the experiments I can do on a system with this state space and the probabilities of their outcomes. And there, we went to the idea that these things describing the probabilities should be, so we went to the idea that we should take this state space, and let's just take, again, a circle as our illustration. We should put it into a vector space that's one dimension higher than what you need for the normalized states, and we have zero down here, and just take the cone of unnormalized states that's generated by it. And then we wanted to look at the dual space, the space of functions from this vector space to real numbers, because something that assigns probabilities to the states, so something that assigns the probability for a specific measurement outcome to every state is going to be such a function. It's going to give a real number for every state. So it's natural to look in the dual space of this vector space, look at the linear functions on this. We gave operational reasons for wanting them to be linear in terms of preserving convex combination. And we said that if you have such a functional that takes values between 0 and 1 on all the normalized states, that's a candidate for a measurement outcome. And we furthermore said that there's going to be a biggest measurement outcome that corresponds to sort of a trivial measurement where you don't get any information. And it's the measurement outcome that just assigns one to all of these normalized states. So you think of these as lying in some plane, and this is the plane where this unit functional is equal to one. And where that intersects the cone of unnormalized states, that's the base of this cone, omega A, of normalized states. And then if we look over at the dual cone of so-called effects, what do the measurements look like? Well, we said they're the interval between the zero functional and this unit functional that gives one on everything normalized. And what that looks like is we have the unit functional up here. We have the dual cone at the origin. In this particular case, the dual cone actually has the same structure as the primal cone. That's not generically true. It's a very important point. But then we have a negative copy of the cone pointing backwards from this unit functional, and we intersect them. And in this case, the intersection happens to be the same shape as the normalized state space. That's another property that's not universal. And so you get this kind of double cone. And that is that's the convex body of normalized effects, the ones that actually always give values between 0 and 1 and that can be interpreted as probabilities. So what I thought perhaps I would do is give a kind of rundown of how classical and quantum theory look in this framework. All right, so has everybody copied down this information? It's going to disappear. So let's take a few examples. Okay, so let's take the unnormalized states, and this is going to be some cone, which I'll call K. What else will we want to know about? We'll want to know about the unnormalized effects. And that's the dual cone, K star. Normalized states, omega. And actually, I think I'm going to associate everything with a system A. And so let's call this A plus. So A is some vector space where these things live, finite dimensional, real vector space. A plus is the cone of unnormalized states. And then A plus, I guess I was using a sharp instead of a star. Sometimes it's equal to A star. Plus and sometimes not. I'll explain that. We have normalized states. We have the unit functional. We have normalized effects. And then I thought maybe we'd talk about extremal states. What I'll call atomic effects, introducing some new concepts. And measurements. And maybe even dynamics, which is another topic we didn't really talk much about last time. Now maybe let's look at classical theory. Classical theory with, let's say, n alternative well, let's just say, n atomic events, let's say, elementary events. D-dimensional quantum theory. Maybe we'll look at a qubit and a real bit as well. Okay, so the unnormalized states here are just Rn plus, positive octant, as we said before. They're just vectors that contain n non-negative entries. For quantum theory, it's just I'll use D instead of N. Let's use N just to make things more comparable. So N corresponds to the maximal number of completely distinguishable outcomes you can have for a measurement. In N-dimensional quantum theory, we have the ambient vector space is N by N Hermitian matrices, and the cone is N by N positive semi-definite matrices. So I probably should have given even another column that just says, what's the ambient vector space? So the ambient vector space here is just Rn. The ambient vector space here is n by n Hermitian matrices. And if you remember, Hermitian just means that if you take the transpose and the complex conjugate, it's equal to the matrix, the original matrix. Let me just mention what the dimension of the ambient vector space is. Here it's n. Here it's n squared, right? So the dimension of the vector space here is larger than the maximal number of distinguishable states that can be distinguished in a single measurement. Whereas in classical theory, the two are equal. The dual cone, these are both self-dual, right? So it's also Rn plus here, and it's also a positive semi-definite matrices. That's a very special property that these things are self-dual. The normalized states here, they're just a simplex. And that is the convex hull of, of n distinguishable points in this case. Not distinguishable. It's the convex hull of n linearly independent points in Rn. And let's just draw a picture, say, for n equals 3, right? It's this triangle here. The unit functional here is just the trace. Here it's x goes to sum of the elements. The normalized effect. So what is the interval? Let's take this 3x3 classical case again and ask what the interval of normalized effects is. We just take the cone. We take the unit functional. And here, let me give an aside, because I think it's an important thing. Yes. Convex hull, yes. So a convex combination, so let's say we have a set S in a real vector space, and let's make it finite dimensional. Okay? So then the convex hull of S, which is sometimes written as conv of S, this is the convex hull, is just the set of all finite convex combinations of elements of S. So it's the set of all vectors of the form sum I, T sub I, X sub I, such that every X sub I is in the set S. And these T sub I's are probabilities, so they sum to 1, and they're positive, non-negative, rather. Okay. So, in other words, you give me any set, maybe it looks like this, maybe it's got a point out here, and some other blob here. And, given any two points in this set, So it's equivalent, actually, to just say that you just close undertaking convex combinations of any two points. Because, you know, when you convex combine two, and then you take the convex combinations of everything that you got by making that line with this line, you get all three-way convex combinations and so forth. So you just take every line, every straight line that can be drawn between two elements in a set, every line segment, and you close it up, and you get this convex hole here. And if that's concave there, you get that gets straightened out as well. So that's all that's meant by a convex hole. Thanks. It's, you know, it's critical to, I don't know, you know, where, what everybody's background is, so it's critical that things like that get cleared up. So that was good. All right, I wanted to mention how you can represent the dual space and the primal space and the same vector space with an inner product, because it makes it a lot easier to draw pictures and a lot easier to get intuition about these things sometimes. So the dual space for a vector space A, right, A star is just the it's the set of functionals. So it's the set of functions from A to the reals. Or, you know, whatever field your vector space is over, it's the functions to that field. In this case, it's the reals. A nice way to represent such a functional is by saying, let's associate it with a vector f in A, and let's introduce an inner product on A, maybe by taking a basis which we'll call, I don't know, E sub I, and then F has components F sub I in this basis. And now we say sum I F I X I. So if I take x in A, and I take it to the real number that is just its dot product with this f, I can think of this f as representing a linear functional, just a linear map from vectors x to real numbers. This is just a real number. And so any linear functional on a space, any element of the dual space, can just be represented as being in the same vector space as long as we've picked an inner product. And that's a very convenient way to represent these effects. The point is this representation is not unique, right? Because it depends on an isomorphism between A star and A, and that's not unique. But that's not really very important. It's often the nicest way to represent these theories is actually to put the dual cone in the primal space. And so I'll represent an inner product. Instead of writing out the dot product in components, I'll just represent an inner product on A. It's just a map that I represent by angle brackets, and it goes from two copies of A to the reals. Okay, and you can specify it by specifying a basis and taking the dot product between the two vectors and the basis. Every choice of basis will give you a different inner product. Okay, so then we can talk about the internal dual cone, which is a good thing to be able to do, to the cone A plus. And so let's call it A star plus, and we'll say it's internal. And it's just defined to be the set of vectors Y in the vector space A, such that for all X in the cone, Y has a positive inner product with X. Okay, so this is a pretty important definition. I think I'll erase all this stuff on the basis. And, well, I'll leave it up for a little while. All right, so does this make sense? We said it's a set of all, you know, the abstract definition of the dual cone is it's all positive linear functionals, positive meaning positive on the primal cone, positive on everything in the primal cone. But now positivity is just represented by this inner product being positive. So, you know, geometrically, the way to think about it is, let's say I have this cone. It's kind of a little narrow version of I mean, there's really not many cones in R2. This is basically it if you want it to be generated. And now I say, well, what's the dual cone to that? Well, having a positive inner product just means that you have to be at an angle less than 90 degrees with everything in this cone. So, you know, here, this has a 90-degree angle with that. Is that in the dual cone? No, because it's got more than a 90-degree angle with this stuff over here. So it can't be in the dual cone. But if I look at what's 90 degrees from here, that can be in the dual cone. And if I look at what's 90 degrees from this ray, that can be in the dual cone. So this is the dual cone. Okay, so in this representation, the dual cone is wider than the primal cone. And if I were to widen out the primal cone, the dual cone would shrink in. And actually, if I would widen this thing out to be 90 degrees, the dual cone would shrink in to also be 90 degrees, and they'd coincide. And now an interesting thing from the point of view of a convex operational theory, where all we care about is probabilities. All we care about is the angles, is the inner products that we get, is that these setups are equivalent, right? Having the wide cone and the skinny cone, or just having them be on top of each other, it makes no difference to the probabilities you're going to get from a theory that's based on this. So the point is, this internal representation is non-unique. Now, one thing I should mention, if you are familiar with the work of Lucy and Hardy, and if you're interested in this area, you should become familiar with it. He likes to describe theories in terms of R vectors, and those are basically effects, and P vectors. And those are basically states. And then he gets probabilities by taking their dot product. Okay, and that's exactly, you know, a representation of this dual cone and primal cone in a single vector space. And I believe, at least initially, Lucian doesn't require that these cones span the ambient vector space. So it's more like he's looking at states on a test space and all possible effects on the state space of that test space. But in any case, if you look in this literature, you often find that there are sort of questions about what's the best way to represent a particular theory in terms of P vectors and R vectors. And it's because of this non-uniqueness. So here, it's possible to choose the inner product such that, you know, you get R2 plus as the cone. R2 plus is also the dual cone. The normalized states are here. The unit functional is here. And so the stuff shaded in red is the effects. This line is the normalized states. You just have to specify a probability and then another probability that add up to 1. So that's why it's this line, 2 probabilities. And then if you want the unnormalized states, your probability can go below 1 and you get this whole triangle. Okay. So the normalized effects, I think we did this last time. These are the unit vectors. This is a nice way of representing classical theory. These are the unit vectors, the normalized effects by that triangle. Atomic effects, okay. So let's look in this case at what the, it's a little tricky, but at what the, that was the state space. So the normalized effects actually involve, well, think about what this unit is. In terms of this dot product representation, it's just the vector 1, 1, 1, right? And then when we have vector x and we take the dot product with 1, 1, 1, we indeed get the sum of the components x. So that means that if we're looking at these things all in the same vector space, the point 1, 1, 1 is out here. And these three points are like 1, 0, 0. 0, 1, 0, and 0, 0, 1. And if we do our usual thing to ask what are the normalized effects, we take the cone, turn it upside down, and intersect it with the original, put its point at the unit and intersect it with the original cone, and we get a cube. Here's U sub A, and here's 0, and here is this 100, 010, 001. And then we get three new points here, which are 110. This one, I guess, is 101. And this one, I guess, is 011. Okay. So now, think of the effects as so the set of normalized effects forms a convex body. And I'll just say one more thing, then I'll get your question. And these are its extreme points as a convex body. Yes?
So I didn't follow how you constructed that representation for the normalized effects from from your convex hull that you had there. Like why did you take this thing and rotate it?
Okay. So we discussed that a bit more last time. And the main point is the general recipe for this is take all x such that 0 is less than or equal to x is less than or equal to this unit functional. Because this ordering, this dual ordering is actually the pointwise ordering on the dual space with respect to the positive cone. It's saying one effect is bigger than another if and only if it gives a bigger probability, or at least no smaller probability, on every single state. So that's sort of a pointwise ordering. And now, we said it's a legitimate effect has to give all probabilities bigger than zero. So that means it has to be bigger than zero in the pointwise ordering. And also, all of its probabilities have to be less than or equal to one. And since the unit effect gives one on every state as its probability, that means any other legitimate effect has to be less than or equal to that unit effect. So you have to have this interval in the dual cone. And remember that we said, you know, x is greater than or equal to y is the same thing as saying x minus y is in the cone, right? And in this case, we're looking maybe at a star plus, since we're looking in the dual cone. And so all we're really saying here is that x has to be bigger than 0, that means it's in the cone, and x has to be less than ua. And that means that, if you like, x has to be in the upside-down cone that you stick on at ua. So this condition is the reason that you take the cone, you stick it upside down, and you put it at ua, because we're saying that that UIA minus X is in the cone, and that means that minus X is in the cone minus U sub A, and therefore X is in U sub A minus the cone, and that's just saying take the cone, take its minus, which is turning it upside down, and then translate it to have its point at U sub A. So that's how, you know, that's how we can think of, that's how we got these classical effects. But classically, I mean, just think of what these things are. We say an effect in classical theory, let's say we have a two atomic outcome classical theory, an effect is just a set of two numbers less than one, and I just take their dot product with my probabilities. Basically, that's just a classical version of a fuzzy observable, if you like. Or in fuzzy set theory, they're sometimes called fuzzy sets. So if you like, asking, you know, measuring classical effect is asking whether or not something is in a fuzzy set. That's a way to think of classical effects. And then quantum effects are sort of the quantum version of fuzzy set theory. Just as people didn't think of fuzzy set theory for quite a while after inventing set theory, people didn't think of quantum effects for quite a while after von Neumann measurements were invented, which are sort of the analog of sharp-edged set theory. Yes? I think that's more of a reference for people living encountered it in engineering and so forth. I mean, so you can do set theory in terms of characteristic functions, where you say the characteristic function of a set takes the value 1 on things that are in the set and 0 on things that are out of the set. And now you're kind of describing your set by a vector in a vector space, right? Because it's the vector space of real-valued functions on that set. And so the sets all correspond to these 0, 1-valued functions. Okay, but now you've got other functions. You could have other functions that take values between 0 and 1. And those are sort of in a very fuzzy way interpreted as meaning, well, this element is sort of in the set to some degree, right? I mean, I don't really like that concept. I prefer to think about probabilities. But so if you take functions that are take values between 0 and 1, those are fuzzy sets. And by doing, you know, replacing ordinary characteristic functions of sets with these fuzzy indicator functions, fuzzy characteristic functions, you're doing what's called fuzzy set theory. And, you know, you can give it a probabilistic interpretation in terms of effects and classical effects and states. And in my view, that's the right way to think about fuzzy set theory. Yes? Well, so it's better to make the analog of, it's better to apply the notion of fuzziness to effects, is what I would say. I mean, but there is, you're kind of right. Mathematically, there is an analogy there in that, let's not get too far into it. But I think that's sort of a reasonable analogy. But really, the fuzzy sets are better thought of in terms of the measurements that you make, the events in classical probability theory. Is it in this set, or is it not in this set? Because, I mean, classically, you're dealing with probability distributions in classically. Those are the analogs of quantum states. And those are sort of fuzzy as well. But let's not get too far into fuzzy classical theory. So I just want to kind of give you an idea of what's going on. Now there's a notion of atomic effects, right? And remember, we have this cone, and the cone has extremal rays. So I'll draw the extremal rays coming out here, and there's this one behind. Okay, and so the effects that are on extremal rays, so here's the definition. These are on extremal rays, and as far out on the ray as possible. Okay, that's not mathematically rigorous language, but it's clear what it means. So in this classical example, here's an atomic effect, here's an atomic effect, here's an atomic effect. And they are extremal in the convex sets sense in the body of effects. But there are these other extremal elements of the convex body of effects, and the unit is also extremal, and so is zero, that aren't atomic. So these ones that are on extremal rays are very special because they're like the fine-grained measurements. They give you maximal information, right? This guy, 110, is just asking, is it in the set consisting of the first and second alternatives? That's not fine-grained. Asking, you know, is it outcome 2? That's fine-grained, and that corresponds to an atomic effect. And geometrically, the atomic effects can be characterized in this way I just described. They're on extremal rays of the cone, and they're also as far out as possible. So the extremal states, I already mentioned, they're just these, in the classical case, they're just these three vectors, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0. So in quantum theory, we have the positive semi-definite matrices. Well, the normalized states are the trace 1 positive matrices. And so if you remember these positive semi-definite matrices, you know, the diagonal elements are always positive, or at least non-negative. And they're the probabilities for the outcomes of making a von Neumann measurement in the basis that you're using to write this state out as a matrix. And they can always be diagonalized. which means you can find a basis, right, in which the off-diagonal elements are zero. But in any case, whatever basis you use, if you add up the diagonal elements, that's the definition of the trace of a matrix, any matrix. But in this case, if you add up the elements and they're positive, the trace will always be positive. And if the trace is 1, you can interpret those diagonal elements as probabilities. And so those are the reasonable positive semi-definite matrices to interpret as quantum states. And indeed, those are the mixed quantum states, where by mixed, I mean it could include the case of pure states as the extremal elements of the convex set. Okay, and we said this unit functional is indeed the trace. So it is just adding up, but now we add up the diagonal elements of the matrix and not everything. The normalized effects, all right, this has gotten messy, but these are just, again, operators X or E, let's say, between 0 and the identity matrix, right? Extremal states are just rank 1 density matrices, right? So they're just projectors. They're rank 1 projectors, though. And how do we describe quantum theory in terms of this inner product representation? Well, we said that both cones were the cones of positive semi-definite matrices. So again, we have this self-dual situation. And the inner product is, you know, x, y. So this is quantum. The inner product is x, y equals trace x, y, where these are, well, x is a density matrix, and y is a POVM element. And so you probably have seen this representation of quantum probabilities before, but there it is again. And of course, in the case that y is a projector, or let's say x is a projector, a pure state, you have trace psi psi y, and that's just equal to the matrix element of y in the state psi, and so forth. And of course, in the case where y itself is a projector, okay, so in quantum theory, the atomic effects are the rank 1 projectors. So they're actually the same as the atomic states. Okay, that's another very special property. And so in that case, you get trace psi psi, and if the effect happens to be a rank 1 projector represented by chi, and of course, that's just psi chi squared, you know, the good old transition probability of quantum mechanics. Okay. All right, let me just say a little bit about what dynamics are in the classical and quantum case. Actually, let me... that for a bit later. So are there any questions about how classical and quantum theory look in this framework? Sort of a lot to absorb, but it gives a conceptually nice way of representing quantum theory and classical theory and a lot of other things and being able to compare them. So let me talk about what dynamics look like in theories described by these convex sets. So I'm not going to be talking about test spaces and dynamics, just the convex sets and the effects framework. And they're very simple. A dynamical evolution is a positive map. So it's a linear map such that, so this is dynamical evolution, let's say, on a system A, which remember we've described as an abstract state space, which has an effect cone A plus, sorry, a state cone A plus, effect cone, and a normalization functional that tells us what the normalized states are. It has the property that if we take the unnormalized state cone, we get an unnormalized states, right? So we don't want to get anything that isn't positive by applying a legitimate dynamics to something, because that means it gives us something that we're not going to be able to interpret as a state. Okay, so let's simplify to the case where we take the effects to be the full dual cone. Everything I've described so far has that property. If we didn't have that, we would have to add the condition that, you know, the adjoint map takes our chosen subcone of the dual cone, it preserves that, at least keeps it inside itself. So it's only needed if A sharp plus is not equal to A star plus, right? So remember, A sharp was just a way of, if we want to restrict the measurements, we can do it. We can say, even though everything in the dual cone is mathematically reasonable, we're going to take less to represent our theory. If you do that, you have to make sure the dynamics respect that restriction. Okay. But if you've got quantum theory or classical theory or any of the huge number of other theories where A sharp is A plus, you just need this condition. Okay, these are called positive maps. All right. Now notice that this may reduce probability, right? So we're going to define let's call it a probability preserving dynamical evolution. And that is a map, so it's a linear map such that if you apply the map phi to the normalized states, you get normalized states. So it's a normalization-preserving map. Yes? Well, I mean, you can easily make one up. For instance, you can make up, you know, you could have classical theory where you just say, here are my two distinguishable classical states. And now I'm going to take a subcone here, and here's the unit functional that would have been on my general classical theory, but I'm going to say only this subcone represents legitimate effects. And therefore, when I take this and I put it upside down, okay, I only have these measurements. So that's a classical theory. Well, you might want to call it classical. Although you can get some pretty non-classical effects by just taking classical theory and starting to restrict what measurements you allow. It's a classical theory where your measurements are inherently fuzzy. So you may have started out by representing your state space as a simplex, but then you're effectively saying, I can never tell for sure whether I've prepared this state. And I can never tell for sure whether I've prepared this state. So even though these states are the least uncertain states you can possibly prepare, you haven't included all the effects that would allow you to tell the difference between them completely reliably. And I mean, reality is probably kind of like that, right? But if you put in enough effort, you can get arbitrarily close to perfectly distinguishing things. So we idealize it and say that it's not fuzzy. So you can make up theories like that. If you are interested in, I mean, has Rob Speckin spoken yet in the course? Yeah, so he's got theories that he constructs by taking classical theories and imposing restrictions on the amount of knowledge you can have about things. The idea being that quantum mechanics is sort of like that. I mean, it imposes like the uncertainty principle that says, you know, if I know something, I can't know too much about something else. And you're naturally led to, you know, start with classical theory and just impose knowledge restrictions. And then you'll tend to get theories like this, where you have to sort of by hand restrict the dual cone. So did that help a bit? Good. So I haven't spent much time investigating these theories, but it's an important distinction. I think it's actually a very important distinction, and Rob lays a lot of stress on it, maybe formulated somewhat differently. You know, theories that you can sort of embed within classical theories and just view them as having restrictions on what you can do, and theories that you actually can't, at least in a nice way, embed. And that's a whole area that's, you know, ripe for study using the convex framework. And I haven't spent much time doing it, but it's worth investigating. Was there another question? Okay, so let me say a little more about dynamics. So we have these probability-preserving dynamical evolutions. And these general ones that just preserve the cone, you know, I think we'll want to say that they are, they're only physically reasonable. So let's say, probability non-increasing, dynamical evolution. And that has the property that for any alpha, can you see this when I move back? Not quite, I guess. So let's do it over here. So we have probability non-increasing dynamics. This is a okay, it satisfies that for any normalized state, phi of alpha think of evaluating this unit functional as a norm. The norm is less than or equal to 1. And, of course, we require that it be positive. Right? So these positive maps include things that are very unphysical in that they'll take a normalized state to a state whose norm is greater than 1. And there's not going to be any probabilistic interpretation of that. If you take a state to a state that is subnormalized, there is an operational interpretation of that. And that's like saying this kind of dynamical evolution is associated with a process whose probability is less than 1. And in fact, evaluating the unit functional on the state that results from applying the process to an initial state tells you the probability of that process. And then these probability-preserving evolutions are evolutions that represent a process that occurs with unit probability. So you're not collecting information in the process. You're just doing something to a system. And you can decompose these sometimes so into maybe phi equals some I phi I. And that's like saying, well, these phi I's are dynamics that could be associated with a bunch of measurement outcomes labeled I. And they add up to this probability-preserving dynamic. So this is a complete set of possible measurement outcomes. So such a set of phi I are sometimes called an instrument, You might encounter that in the literature. I sort of don't like it because it suggests that it has to be an experiment that somebody designed. But you see it a lot. Okay, and then if you look at the result of, let's say you have such an instrument, and you look at the unit functional, and you apply it, you know, you follow psi sub I with the unit functional, okay, that turns out to be an effect, right? Because the unit functional takes things to the reals. And so here we took a state to a state and then went to the reals. And so that's the effect, if you like, that's associated with this process. So this instrument is like a measurement described in terms of the dynamics that occur to the state conditional on each measurement outcome. And then you recover the probabilities are also encoded because these phi sub i's reduce the norm of the state in exactly the way that tells you what the probability of the process is when that state goes in. And then if you don't want the details of the conditional dynamics and you just want to have a measurement, the generalized analog of POVM, just a set of effects that sum to the unit effect, you can define these effects, E sub I should have called them, and then you have sum I, E sub I is, in fact, the unit effect. Okay. So that's how dynamics get represented in the theory. Now, you might think, well, a nice kind of dynamics to have is just to allow, you know, as our probability-preserving maps, all possible probability-preserving positive maps. All positive maps, right? Everything of this sort. And then maybe for our general ones, just allow, again, all positive ones without the restriction to preserving this this base. But just like I said, you might be motivated to reduce the cone of effects you're allowed to have in your theory. You might also be motivated to reduce the cone of positive maps that you allow in your theory. Okay, so I didn't say it, but it's true that the positive maps form a cone. Let me make some space to write these things down. So it's a fact that the positive maps form a cone. And I'll say a little more about the structure of this cone in a second. But in fact, it's what I called a regular cone earlier. So recall that means it's pointed, it's closed, and it's generating. And it lives inside the real vector space of linear maps from A to B, let's say. So the positive maps, these are now phi A to B. Okay, now notice when I defined dynamics here, I said they were on a single system, but you can extend the definition to say I have a dynamics that actually takes one system to another system. You know, maybe it changes the type of system you have, and it still just has to preserve the positive cone, or at least take the positive cone into itself. Okay, so in the case of restricting effects, I said that was kind of weird. We didn't need to do it to represent classical theory. We don't need to do it to represent quantum theory. In the case of quantum theory, it's kind of surprising. We actually do need to restrict the maps we allow. We can't allow all positive maps. You guys know this already, probably? Okay, so some people know it. Certainly, if you're studying quantum information, you probably know it. The cone of all positive maps in quantum theory is larger than the cone of so-called completely positive maps. And so in quantum theory, we do actually restrict the dynamics to be completely positive, at least almost all the time. I guess there are a few papers where people argue it's useful to use more general maps for some purposes, but it's not widely done. And the reason is that completely positive maps, if you try to apply them to a subsystem, and this subsystem is entangled with some other system, there's no way of making, you know, an independent application of a general positive map to a subsystem that is actually positive on the larger system. So we're still concerned with positivity, but we have to be careful about what happens when you hit just part of a system. And that's the motivation for restricting the quantum maps to completely positive maps. So I'll say a little more about exactly the exact form of the completely positive quantum maps, because it's interesting. But first, I'm going to define some more special classes of dynamics. Actually, first I'm going to say another important fact about these cones. This is proved in a paper. It's by Wills. Well, it's by Barnum. Gabler and Wills. It's on Quant PH. December 09. It's like the last possible day to post or something. Okay, and in it we prove, although I think this must be folklore that's known somewhere, we prove that, I'll state it, and then I'll do the next thing I was going to do, which is tell you what the terms in it mean. So, automorphisms of the cone A plus are extremal in the cone of positive maps from A plus to A plus. Or some people actually write this L plus of A plus, A plus, whatever, just notation. And by extremal here, I mean they're on extremal rays, right? Okay, there's a lot to say to make that make sense, so I'll go ahead and do it. Excuse me? Oh, so this is part of what I have to say. The notion of extreme point in a cone, people often refer to extreme points in a cone. What they mean is that they're on extremal rays of the cone. And it's not, even though a cone is a convex set, this is sort of confusing, but you need to be warned about it because you'll run into it. And it confused me for a while. So even though a cone is a convex set, its set of extremal points is not very interesting. If it's a pointed cone, this is it. Zero is the only extremal point. That's the only point in a cone that cannot be represented as a convex combination of other points. Because even if I have a point on an extreme ray, it's a convex combination of other points on the same extreme ray. Okay. So we sort of say, well, that doesn't really count. We'll call a point extremal if it can't be represented as a convex combination of points that aren't multiples of itself. In other words, if it's on an extremal ray. And then when you slice across the cone look at a base, the parts of the base that are on extremal rays are actually extremal points of the resulting convex set. So they'll be extremal points in the state space. Right, and so what I mean by saying the automorphisms are extremal in the cone of positive maps is precisely that they are on extremal rays of that cone. And now I'll tell you what an automorphism is. Okay, so an automorphism is just a positive map that preserves the cone. So an automorphism of A plus is it's a linear map, phi, such that psi of A plus is not only a subset of A plus, but in fact equal to A plus. Okay? And then some important facts about these. So automorphisms form a group. Let me give an equivalent characterization. Equivalently, phi is positive. In other words, phi of A is a subset of A plus. and phi is invertible and has a positive inverse. Okay. Now it's obvious that the composition of positive maps is another positive map, and so we have that the automorphisms of A plus form a group. And it's usually written ought of A plus. Okay. And so, you know, the properties of that group are extremely important in understanding the geometry of cones. There's a subgroup of this group that's also very important. And we say, so we say that phi is a symmetry of our abstract state space, which I guess we've been defining by A plus and U sub A. Let's forget about A sharp for the moment. If phi of omega equals omega. So the normalized phi is a normalization preserving automorphism, right? It's just equivalent to say it's a base preserving automorphism. Right, because omega is a base for the cone, and so if phi preserves omega exactly, then if you put in a multiple of omega, you get something else in the cone, and so it clearly also preserves k exactly. So these are, well, let's say a little about what these are in quantum mechanics to get a better sense of what's going on. So, in quantum mechanics, the automorphisms are okay, we take our X, our Hermitian matrix X, and we transform it to AX A dagger. And here A is any non-singular matrix, it's square because going from A to A. So it's a non-singular matrix, or if you like, non-singular linear operator, if you're not thinking in a matrix representation. Okay, so for all non-singular matrices, this is an automorphism. That's a continuum of automorphisms. And then let's just think in terms of what's a set of generators for the group. So we only need one more generator. Pick a basis and take X to X transpose in that basis. Okay. Now the actual automorphism group allows you to do, you know, has the transpose in whatever basis you want. But we can always get there by, you know, changing basis, doing the transpose, and changing basis back. And we can change basis this way. Okay. So that's a full description of the automorphism group of quantum mechanics. And yes, Cos.
Say anything more about the similarities or differences between these theories and quantum mechanics?
Which theories?
So the general theories. So you can talk a lot about the mathematical formalism.
So I will in a second, but actually this formalism, well, I'll describe some of the differences in terms of this formalism. So that's sort of preparing for that. And maybe that won't be as satisfactory as a fully operational description of the differences. It will illuminate it. Okay. This is not completely positive. Just saying. Right? If you take an entangled state and you do the transpose only on part of it, you don't necessarily get a legitimate state back. You don't necessarily get a positive semidefinite matrix. So these, even though they're automorphisms of the cone, they're not allowed dynamics in quantum theory. Classically, if you have n alternatives, the automorphism group is just the symmetric group. You can permute the alternatives. But that's the base preserving automorphism group. And probably if you want the full automorphism group, you just have a bunch of copies of R because you can independently shrink or stretch the extreme ordinates. And you combine that with Sn.
From SN to, so if the automorphism group get restricted to quantum mechanics from SN to
ones are progressive.
Sorry, the automorphism group?
In quantum mechanics, is that an ascending class of the interval possible?
Yes. Yes.
What are the cases in quantum?
What is the automorphism group in quantum mechanics? So I just gave you a set of its generators. It's basically this action of the general linear group, which I guess maybe is a projective action. And then we don't include this sum. Well, it would be a continuous symmetric group, and you'd be restricting it somehow, so it might be nasty. Okay. So let me just say what the base preserving dynamics are. X goes to sum over I, A sub I, X, A sub I, dagger in quantum mechanics. These are the CP maps. But now A sub I don't have to be non-singular. So it's a very, I think, deep fact about quantum mechanics that you just take convex combinations of automorphisms, or, in order to get the non-singular things, limits of sequences of automorphisms, right? Because there's a non-singular matrix. Well, it's not trivial, but nevertheless true that... you can get to singular matrices by as limits of non-singular matrices where so some operationally important properties of quantum mechanics that can be described in terms of the automorphism group are things like this. So the automorphism group, did I call it the symmetry group? Let's call it the symmetry group. So the base preserving part of the automorphism group acts, so let's call this is a group, and we'll call it the symmetries of A. It acts transitively on the extremal points of the base, right? So not only does it take pure states to pure states, which it has to, but what this means, this acts transitively means, given any pure alpha and beta, I can find a automorphism such that phi of alpha equals beta. So if you look, for example, at Lucien Hardy's papers from around 2000, 2001, which I strongly urge you to do if you find this stuff at all interesting, because he's got a characterization of quantum mechanics, or at least of a class of theories that's close to quantum mechanics, in terms of axioms that can be expressed in this framework. One of his axioms is that there is a transitive action of, part of one of his axioms says that there's a transitive action of this symmetry group on the pure states. He also adds the axiom, I believe, that there is a, for any two pure states, there's a continuous path of pure states such that there are automorphisms that take you all the way along this path. Is that a reasonable way of describing that, would you say, Klaus? Yeah. Classical theory also has this transitive action on the extremal states, right? The symmetric group, when you permute the classical alternatives, it can take any alternative to any alternative. But there isn't this continuous path between any pure state and any other pure state that you can push the state along with automorphisms. So that's one fundamental difference between classical and quantum theory. So I think I will finish up by just describing another mathematical property that's easily formulated in terms of these things and leads to something close to a characterization of quantum mechanics, a couple of properties, actually. So we say a cone, A plus, let's say, is homogeneous if its automorphism group acts transitively on the interior of the cone. This is the topological interior. So in quantum mechanics, what is that? It's the density matrices that have no zero eigenvalues, all positive eigenvalues. In classical theory, it's the probability distributions that are not zero on any of the fundamental alternatives. Okay, and we say it's self-dual if we represent it in the primal space, what I was calling, let's say, A star plus internal, the internal dual, is equal to A. Quantum theory and classical theory both share this property. And let me just note that this is self-duality is stronger than weak self-duality. And weak self-duality is something we define by just saying, right, there exists an isomorphism, phi, such that it takes the positive cone of states to the positive cone of effects. Right here, we stick them in the same vector space, and the isomorphism can be the identity map. In general, that's not true. And here's an example. It's the state space of that square bit that I mentioned earlier. You look at its cone, and you look at the dual cone, and it's isomorphic. It has a square base, but the square base is rotated by pi over 4. And there's just no way to choose the inner product on this space such that the dual cone becomes equal to the primal cone. So it's kind of this, you might have thought these two things would be the same, but they're not. Okay, so I guess the last thing I'll mention, since we're running over time, is a very deep theorem that gets you pretty close to quantum mechanics. And so the theorem is that a finite dimensional homogeneous self-dual cone is the state space of a Euclidean Jordan algebra, and before you get annoyed at me introducing a term like that, I'll just tell you what they are. I'll just give you a list of these state spaces. Okay, so I guess this theorem is due to Kosher and maybe independently a guy named Vinberg in about 58 and 61 and 1958 and 61. And then this classification is due to Jordan, Pascual Jordan, von Neumann, and Wigner. And it just says these are the positive semi-definite real symmetric matrices or complex Hermitian matrices or quaternionic. And there's a generalization of Hermitian to quaternionic, I'll put it in quotes, matrices. Or they're Lorentz cones. So the base is a ball. Or, okay, they're the positive semi-definite 3x3 octonionic Hermitian matrices. So there's this one weird case. Okay. And then we also allow, right, direct sums or products. I forget what you call them, but so So these aren't too interesting. They just say we can also take a bunch of these cones and say we allow all states that are incoherent combinations of these, where, you know, all the extreme points lie in one or the other of the cones that we've added up. So really, the interesting structure is in the irreducible ones. And this is basically, you know, quantum mechanics over real vector spaces, quantum mechanics over complex vector spaces, quantum mechanics over quaternionic vector spaces, which is kind of weird. People don't understand very well yet. And then you have these ball-shaped spaces. And, you know, they have some odd properties, like the number of distinguishable states in a theory, in a system that's described by a ball, no matter how high the dimension of this ball of normalized states is, there's only two perfectly distinguishable states at a time. So any antipodal pair of states on this ball can be perfectly distinguished by some measurement, but there's no set of states that can be perfectly, of three states that can be perfectly distinguished by a measurement or more. So, you know, they have sort of very weird informational properties. And then this is just a bizarre outlying case that mathematicians are very interested in. So, you know, a project that's very interesting and that we're partway along in, me and some collaborators, is getting an operational understanding of what homogeneity means, operational understanding of what self-duality means, maybe getting some more operational principles that restrict you even farther to complex quantum mechanics, and also thinking of ways of making composite systems out of systems like this. And we've actually got some ideas along those lines. And so I can see that I basically presented the basic mathematics of this framework and how quantum theory fits into it. I haven't said very much about further results in the framework and how they actually relate to information processing. And there are a lot of such results, but we're only partway along in the project of characterizing quantum mechanics in information processing terms. So maybe when I give Joe the notes, I will include some stuff about those results and references to them. And I think what you've gotten in these two lectures is just the basics that maybe allow you to start reading the literature and understand the mathematics of the approach. So I believe we're over time, right? So that's it.